From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 9th day of August 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the agricultural cash grain markets with Matt Payne of the Andersons right here in Champaign County. Kurt Kimmel will be here, too. He'll help us look at the agricultural futures markets from Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. And then as we round out the first half hour of the program, we'll discuss the agricultural weather forecast with Josh Darr at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. Josh will tell us that when he looks at the Black Sea area or Russia and the wheat growing regions, he thinks more of, well, the United States during the Dust Bowl era. We'll have a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast for that part of the world and for the Midwest when we talk with Josh Darr closer to the bottom of this half hour. And then in the second half hour of our program, we call that the Farming World, Dan Anderson will be here. He's a sustainable agricultural researcher here in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. There's a great sustainable ag conference coming up for veterinarians later this week. We'll give you details on how to sign up, and we'll discuss some of the study abroad options in the sustainable agricultural programs in the College of ACES. It all happens right here on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. Up next, the numbers from the CME Group in Chicago and the Kansas City Board of Trade.
The Closing Market Report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to Cooley at admworld.com.
It's a Monday afternoon. This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason. Here's what the weather forecast for the area looks like. It says today, it'll be partly sunny with a high near 92, south to southwest winds around 9 miles an hour. And then tonight, partly cloudy skies, low about 71 degrees, south winds between 3 and 6 miles an hour. A 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms tomorrow, partly cloudy, a high near 92. The heat index values as high as 101 with light south-southwest winds tomorrow. And then tomorrow night, 73 degrees for the low, mostly cloudy skies, light southwest winds again. On Wednesday, another chance of showers, 30% thunderstorms, mostly cloudy skies, high near 92, west-southwest winds at 5 to 7 miles an hour. And then Wednesday night, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy, a low around 74. Looking further out on Thursday, partly cloudy, a high near 92. Thursday night, partly cloudy, a low of 72. Friday, mostly sunny skies, a high near 91. Friday night, partly cloudy, a low of 70 in the area, and mostly sunny on Saturday with a high near 93. The Saturday night extended forecast says the low will be about 69 degrees. Skies will be partly cloudy, and by the time we get to Sunday, it'll be sunny with a high near 87 degrees. We'll take a more complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour, and we talk with Josh Darr of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. On this Monday afternoon, Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, joins us to take a look at the agricultural futures markets. Kurt, thank you so much for doing this program a bit early. For those of you listening, Kurt and I are recording early because I'm out of the office this afternoon. It's roughly 10:30 a.m. in the morning when we're having this discussion. What's the marketplace been like for you the last week or so?
Well, the last week has just been a dynamic market in general, with wheat being the main news item just about every 10 to 15 minutes. Started off with basically, you know, talk of a smaller production, numbers coming on the world side of the equation, then all of a sudden the export bans, and all of a sudden exports commitments going to be fulfilled, and then all of a sudden, you know, speculative side of the equation seeing some positions having to be liquidated both on the upside and downside. So it was quite a dramatic effect, but over the last week it's given producers an opportunity to get caught up on some marketing here due to the expense of the specialty crowd coming into the marketplace.
Were you surprised that the CME Group made a quick decision to increase margins on the wheat contracts?
No, not at all. This is normal routine occurrences anytime you have a dynamic move in the marketplace. You see them to come in and take action. In fact, margins, you know, were probably at the lower end. Wheat margin was only $1,000 a contract. That's 20 cents, you know, before this got going, and you saw wheat basically rally almost $4 off the low. Friday's range, you're talking almost over a dollar, so it's the best interest to have the funds to back these positions. And this is typical whenever you start seeing volatility increase, you just got to have more funds to back up these transactions.
Do you think that the problems in Russia, I suppose part of the Black Sea and the drought, I've seen it been at least at once in writing compared to 1988 here in the United States, is a regional problem that will be solved fairly quickly in terms of other wheat supplies moving into the marketplace?
Yeah, that's the big debate. We'll have a handle on what we in the U.S. here feel the production number will be and what their exports will be. There's ideas that on the world supply-demand balance sheet that we need to make up about 19 to 20 million metric ton shortfall. That's 700 to 750 million bushels. The thing is that we've got every country in the world producing wheat, but we've got production problems in every country of the world. The most public one and the most devastating right now is the Black Sea area, where those countries feed into that region. And we're also starting to see concerns in Western Australia and some other areas. But to answer your question, I think the market's trading the future. Yeah, we'll see a smaller crop, but that crop's being harvested. The problem or concern will be as we go into next year, if these areas, especially Russia, Ukraine, and through there, if they don't start receiving moisture, it's going to be awful hard to get the wheat germinating up and growing before winter sets in, and that could be even more bullish as we move down the road.
Does the current price range for corn and beans and wheat represent opportunity in your mind for producers to market some of each of those crops?
It depends if you've got a good crop coming on. For those who've received good rains and are comfortable with production prospects, yes. We're basically back above the winter highs. A month ago, we were looking at cash corn $3, coming out of the field. Now we're up over $4 in some areas. So when you plug that into the cash flow, it's profitable. It warrants catch-up sales. Beans are quite a bit higher from where we were last winter. So you plug in these current numbers, it's something to consider. We would probably save some inventory in case this thing runs another notch or two higher to make some additional sales higher. The number one strategy from producers that been looking at and implementing is some put options with this run in here. If you don't want a forward price cash grain, do it to a wide basis. That's one way to sort of hedge your bet a little bit here, is to buy a put to put a floor on you. And secondly is, if you look on out into the deferred contracts, there's some carry there where you could just do a good old-fashioned hedge and capture some of this carry with July corn futures around that 450 area.
Now, speaking of carry, while there is carry in the marketplace for the corn, there's really not a carry in the bean market at this point, and that usually tells producers they ought to go ahead and make a sale.
Yeah, you know, China's been a huge buyer here. They've kicked in their buying program. They're wanting to get aggressive and make sure they've got supplies heading to China here this fall and this winter, and the demand's up front, and it's a perfect opportunity to price the beans and look at, like, replace ownership on paper, some type of paper action due to the fact that the market is flat, like you mentioned, and in the past history that often signals to be aggressive on moving ahead of fall.
And then take up the wheat market, or for those producers who call you and say, you know what, I'm gonna harvest my beans, I'm gonna put wheat into the ground, are you having them go ahead and make sales?
It depends how aggressive they want to get on their marketing plan. If it's profitable, yes, go ahead and do it. Lock it in, because the news or things could change in a hurry. The problem with wheat is marketing ahead, especially on the cash side, is you just don't know what type of crop you're going to have in the spring. And so guys are been a little bit more aggressive looking at doing a good old-fashioned hedge, because when you look at these price levels, this new crop wheat in this 750 area, it makes it very attractive to get some hedges in place, because guys in the south can come back with some double crop beans. And that's one of the number one combinations to increase cash flow without a whole lot of overhead compared to corn.
USDA will release those updated numbers this week. Got any guesses?
Well, I've not had a whole lot of success out guessing the USDA, but this report's going to be more critical than the rest, because there's going to be some actual observation as far as corn and beans go. On the corn, I'm going to go out on a limb and say they're probably going to start fine-tuning harvested acres, maybe lose lower harvested acres a tad bit here, but yield's probably going to be a bushel or two higher. When it's all said and done, we have a feeling that corn carryout could maybe be 1.35 billion bushel, about 20 million bushel less than last month, due to an increase in demand side of the equation. On beans, the numbers will probably be two different ones from the point of old crop beans versus new crop beans. Old crop beans ending stocks could be just maybe 5 to 10 million bushels tighter due to good exports and an aggressive crush number. New crop bean inventory ending stocks probably go up maybe 10 million bushels due to probably a little higher yield. And, of course, the granddaddy of them all would be the wheat estimates, and it'll be the world wheat numbers in the country breakdown according to what they see as far as production and the demand side of the equation on exports. Exports mainly, because that'll give us an idea of what shortfall needs to be made up by the world, not only on wheat, but corn as a feed grain, too.
Turn your attention very quickly to the livestock numbers, cattle numbers, live cattle numbers up on the high end of the trade. Hogs there, but they're falling back. What do you make of it?
Well, in the cattle complex, we've had a run in here. We're due to see some consolidation. with the heat around this summer, it's probably slowed some demand. It has put stress on some feed operations. We feel the livestock sector is probably a non-event here on the beef side here for another month or so, and then we'll see how weather and demand unfolds here as we get into September past Labor Day retail featuring. As far as the hogs go, seasonally, we see strength as we go into the first part of August. We've seen that. Then we start to tail off as we go into this fall. So I would look for the hog market to follow the good old-fashioned seasonal tendencies as we move into the first part of October.
Thanks for taking the time with us today, Kurt.
Very good.
Kurt Kimmel is with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, and joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Monday afternoon.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Well, up next, you know, Illinois corn farmers should be scouting fields for a new disease, new to them anyway. I'll have more on southern corn rust. Rusts are caused by fungal pathogens in a plant. They're airborne diseases and generally not winter hardy. A rust of all types travel northward from the southern United States. And farmers in the Midwest will be familiar with the patterns of Asian soybean rust, which to this point has not generally arrived early enough in the season to damage the soybean crop. They won't, however, be very familiar with the southern corn rust. It, too, usually arrives too late to cause a problem in corn states like Illinois. And that's not the case this year, says University of Illinois Extension plant pathologist Carl Bradley.
We've seen it before. It generally shows up late enough where it doesn't cause too big of a problem, although in the last couple of years, it has shown up down in southern Illinois. And in fact, it has shown up in some of my fungicide trials I've had at Dixon Springs down in Pope County in the southeastern part of the state, as well as over in Belleville over in the southwestern part of the state. And in those trials where it has shown up early enough, we've seen differences of anywhere between 5 and 30 bushel an acre differences between treated and untreated with the fungicide. So it can be a severe problem. It just has to show up early enough in the growth stage that it would still cause yield loss. So I think for this year, any late-planted corn would especially be some that you'd want to target and scout for.
Southern corn rust has been scouted in Illinois cornfields all the way to the Wisconsin border this season. Bradley says it is an economically troubling crop for one very simple reason.
Almost every hybrid planted is susceptible to southern rust. And that's why, lots of times when we talk about rust on corn, people are thinking about common rust. And most hybrids that we plant have good resistance to common rust. Common rust has been around this year. That's not a disease that we typically think is economically important in our typical yellow dent hybrid corn. But southern rust can be a problem just because there's no resistance.
Well, this susceptibility, remember Bradley's trials show a 5 to 30 bushel yield loss, means it is vital producers scout for southern corn rust and that they know the difference between it and common rust.
So southern rust and common rust can look similar. One of the ways to tell them apart is to just look at the pustules themselves on the leaves. With common rust, the color of the pustules are going to be more of a cinnamon, sort of a cinnamon brown colored. Whereas with southern rust, the pustules are going to look much more orange colored. The pustules are going to be smaller with southern rust. And then the other thing with southern rust is the pustules are typically going to be on the upper side of the leaf, whereas with common rust, you can find it on both the upper and underside of the leaf.
One more difference between the two corn rust diseases is that southern corn rust, unlike common rust, can thrive under hot, humid conditions. Well, that makes this season, at least so far, a good southern corn rust incubator. Bradley says there are not any solid economic thresholds for when a southern corn rust outbreak should be treated with a fungicide. He's really only worried about the late planted corn that's still in the milk stage or prior. That, he says, he'd treat if southern corn rust were present. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support comes from Taylor & Martin Auctions, which is holding an auction of over 100 pieces of large late-model ag equipment from John Deere, Case, and Cat on Tuesday, August 10th at 10 a.m. at Progress City in Decatur, Illinois. Online bidding is available at tmilive.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Monday afternoon. Matt Payne is on the phone line with us to talk about the agricultural cash grain market. Good afternoon to you, Matt. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
No, I'm doing very well. So it's been an interesting few days in the marketplace as wheat rallied and then fell back. And we heard about the Russian drought in more detail. But it's been having an impact in Chicago and I suppose on the cash grain market. How are you viewing the whole global development?
Absolutely. I mean, it seems like wheat has definitely been the front runner in terms of driving the market. Today we got word that Australia has got some much needed rains, and that's kind of been driving the wheat market back up a little bit from this roller coaster that we've been having. I still think we're probably going to be trending more sideways the next few days until our report on the 12th. But I still feel like it's probably going to be fairly friendly considering the dryness we've been having and some quality issues that we're going to probably see more widespread across the Grain Belt and the southern states.
So over time, you think this will be a place for corn to replace wheat as a feed grain in parts of the world?
It definitely could. It definitely could. We've been getting a lot of inquiries with customers wanting to do some July 11 wheat sales that from customers that typically are not wheat driven. But with quality issues that we had last year with wheat and the uncertainty, I think most guys around here will probably stick to their corn. I did get a guy telling me that he was not going to do any corn on corn this next year because of the quality he's seeing with his corn on corn crop. So,
oh, interesting. Speaking of the corn, did producers take advantage last week, and are they still calling today about making new crop sales?
Absolutely. Guys are selling both fall delivery of 2010 and 2011. When prices are $4 cash, it's kind of hard to walk away from that number.
And we need to note that this is prior to the close, so the numbers you'll give us now and basis is based off current trade. What do your numbers look like for the day?
Fall delivery, we are 387, Dece 405. January 412, and for beans, we are fall delivery 10.05, December 10.10, January 10.10.
Okay, before I let you go, we better talk about that $10 mark. Is that pushing producers to make sales?
Absolutely. I mean, when we were just a month ago, nine and some change to not being $10 sales, it's very advantageous, and there's no real carry in the market. Guys need to store their corn and bring their beans to town in the fall.
Okay, thanks much, Matt.
No problem. Have a great day.
Matt Payne is with the Andersons, located right here in Champaign County, Illinois. Back in 2 minutes when we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast. This is the Monday edition of the Closing Market Report.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgro seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
It's National Rice Pudding Day. While rice puddings are found in nearly every area of the world, rice was first cultivated in Asia. On this day in agricultural history in 1842, the U.S.-Canada border was defined by the Webster-Ashburton Treaty. The treaty also had clauses for extradition as well as prevention of African slave trade. In 1910, Alva Fisher of Chicago, Illinois, patented the electric washing machine. U.S. electric washing machine sales reached 913,000 units in 1928. By the way, the first laundromat in the U.S. was in Fort Worth, Texas in 1934. previous to the electric washing machine, washing machines were cranked by hand or the wash was scrubbed on a washboard. The scrub board was invented in 1797. In 1911, John Gates died. Gates was an inventor, promoter, and barbed wire manufacturer. He discovered a market for wire fencing on the Western Plains, and he helped convince ranchers to adopt barbed wire. Ultimately, he organized the American Steel and Wire Company. Incidentally, one of the first patents in the U.S. for barbed wire went to Joseph Glidden of DeKalb, Illinois. He made modifications to earlier versions. Glidden's wire, named the Winner, was produced by the Barb Fence Company in DeKalb. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Monday afternoon. Time to check the agricultural weather forecast. Josh Starr of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois, is on the phone line. Thanks for being with us today, Josh. Tell me about weather here in the Midwest, and then you probably ought to catch us up on what's been happening in Russia, Ukraine, and the Black Sea area, too.
Absolutely. Well, let's start here close to home. The pattern here this week continues to be a very dominant influence of the ridge of high pressure, which we've seen most of the summer. However, the change here this week is that Wednesday and Thursday have the potential to be the warmest and muggiest days of the summer yet, particularly across places such as central Iowa, north central Illinois, into portions of the Great Lakes. We have thunderstorm activity. One complex moved across Iowa last night, is moving across northern Illinois earlier this morning. And then we have another complex that comes across tonight into tomorrow morning. But after that, the ridge moves further north. We have temperatures in the mid-90s, high humidity, and that combination will likely cause a little touch of stress for crops across portions of Iowa and Illinois. Thereafter, the big headline here is that as we head towards the weekend, we actually have a cold front coming down from Canada, which is something we haven't been able to say much of this summer. That moves south through the Midwest over the weekend and then gets hung up across the Central Plains and Delta early next week. And so we actually go back towards seasonal temperatures early next week, and the humidity drops off, which is something that we have not seen in many weeks here across the Midwest.
And maybe you better take us out west just to tell us what conditions are like there, especially in the western parts of Iowa, Nebraska, and Minnesota.
Yeah, with the 30-day, you look at 30-day precipitation totals across those areas, and most of Iowa has had that west wet bias. So has southeastern South Dakota, northeastern Nebraska. You go north into Minnesota, however, there's been a bit of a dry bias there. So as the thunderstorm activity lifts north tonight, there is a chance you bring some of that southern Minnesota acreage into play with thunderstorm activity, which would be great given that they're running 25-30% below normal rainfall over the past 30 days. Iowa, they just don't need any more rainfall.
Now you can take us to Ukraine, Russia, the Black Sea area, where they've been under some serious stress. I saw one little thing that suggested it was very much like 1988 here in the Midwest, in parts of Russia. How dry is it?
Easily, you could say this statement with certainty, the worst drought they've had in 130 years of record keeping. So in some senses, it's more analogous to the Dust Bowl years of the mid-30s here in the U.S. The heat has just been phenomenal. Moscow broke its all-time high temperature last week. They tied it again over the weekend. That was a record from August 1920. Ukraine, Belarus broke their all-time record highs over the past 7 days. And the moisture deficits are severe there. Some portions of the grain belt in Russia has not seen rain since early June. So you're talking 60 days plus with no rainfall. And the heat continues. There's no real sign that this ridge breaks down, at least over the next 2 weeks, to give any relief to the core of the winter wheat belt across Russia, which raises big concerns about the upcoming planting season.
Josh Darr is with Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report. Stay with us if you can for the farming world. For the rest of you, you can always listen to it online at willag.org.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is the Farming World News and information from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason in studio with us today, Dan Anderson. He's a sustainable ag researcher here on this campus in Urbana-Champaign at the U of I. Mr. Anderson, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Todd.
Hey, you've got some big events that are actually coming up pretty shortly that we ought to talk about before we really get started into your research, because there's a midsummer veterinary conference this week.
Yeah, Thursday and Friday. It's not too late to register. The Midsummer Veterinary Conference for Sustainable Agriculture. U of I is helping to sponsor it, but this is a conference that's gone on for a couple of years. David Bain, a local veterinarian, kind of heads it up, and the vet school has been involved in the past, and it's mainly for veterinarians or anybody in animal care who's interested in more holistic kind of treatment options and alternative medicine for animals.
What will they find on the agendas for Thursday and Friday?
Thursday's farm tours. We have two farm tours, one going north, one going south. The one north will visit an organic sheep farm near Kankakee, and also in that same tour, they'll go to Kilgus Dairy, which is an organic dairy. The one going south, go to an integrated livestock crops farm, Jack Harrisman's farm, and Stan Schutte's farm. Both those are kind of integrated crops, livestock farms, and they'll talk about how they care and manage their animals.
So what's the difference between veterinary care on a sustainable ag farm as opposed to the kind of veterinary care that might be typical on another type of livestock farm?
Well, it's interesting. We visited those farms just as a pre-visit to get ready for the tours and talk to those farmers about their animals. They're all on pasture. Most of them are on grass and pasture year-round. And what struck me is how much less vet care those farmers actually need. So their vets come breeding time, and those farmers still use artificial insemination and things like that. But because those animals are out on pasture, they need a lot less care. If they're organic, they can't have antibiotics or any kind of treatment like that anyway. So it's mainly just letting animals do what they do naturally. There are alternative medicines that are allowed on the organic, for the organic things, but treating with environment.
Is the amount of care and less care that these animals need in part due because they're not in closer confined quarters? Is that really it's the same thing happens with humans. The closer we put us together, the more disease spreads or the more things that happen in our world, and
sure.
Same thing I assume happens with the animals.
That's exactly right. That's the animals in confinement need more care, need more antibiotics and shots and whatnot, just to allow them to live in that environment. So when you take them out of that environment, they just tend to be healthier. So. So that's the story there.
So tell me, how do vets and others that might... It's open to vets, I assume. Who else might be welcome to come along? And how do they make their reservation to go?
Students, of course, are welcome. Vets, anybody interested in animal care. Even farmers would probably learn a lot of things, livestock farmers. But the website is www.mvc-sa.com. So that's MVC, Midsummer Veterinary Conference sustainableagsa.com. I don't know if that's clear. You can edit
that's
this
pretty
out.
Easy. No,
yeah,
that's pretty
clear.
Easy to do.
So they can go there, they can register, they can learn more about the program, the Thursday tours, more details there, and then the program on Friday. It's at the iHotel here in Champaign. There's still rooms available, of course, and that's the best place to learn and register for it.
Can they go to one day or the other if they want?
Sure. Yeah, they can forego the tours if they want and just come to the conference.
How much is the cost?
The tour is $75 if you register beforehand, $100 if you try to register at the door, because we have to know the numbers. The conference itself is $200 beforehand and then $250 at the door. If you're a student, pretty good discount, $100 and $100 to pre-register. And so that's the cost for just the one day, the Friday.
And so they can still go online, pre-registration available until?
Until
you decide
Wednesday.
To close it.
Yeah.
Until Wednesday. There you go.
Yeah.
Until Wednesday. That for the Midsummer Veterinary Conference for Sustainable Ag, Thursday and Friday of this week. So if veterinarians would like to go, others that are interested in taking a tour of the farms or coming to the iHotel here in Champaign, Illinois, can and take that in. Let's talk about some of your sustainable ag research. You've been doing some work with some weeds.
Yeah, thistle.
Canadian thistle? Or?
Canada thistle, yep. Okay. And this started a couple years back. It's a SARE-funded project, Sustainable Ag Research Education from the USDA. It's based on research done here at the U of I. Abe Bixler and John Masunas, Professor John Masunas, heard from farmers, organic farmers, that they're having serious problems controlling Canada thistle, which is not a problem for non-organic farmers, but for organic farmers, it's a perennial weed and it's quite a challenge.
They're having problems in their pastures, which is where I think about seeing Canada thistle, or in their fields, or both?
Both, but mainly fields, field crops. They don't have stingers, the main herbicide that farmers will use to kill Canada thistle. Of course, organic farmers don't have access to that. And so Abe and Dr. Masunas developed this protocol for controlling Canada thistle that showed promise. And in the field here and in the greenhouse. And so what we did then is, after the fact, got a grant from SARE to take that method and take it out and do on-farm research with farmers in Illinois and surrounding states to see how it really works in the real world.
For those who do not know what Canada thistle is, if you've ever stepped on one with bare feet, you know. And I did as a kid many times,
yeah.
But
yeah.
Out in the pastures. That's why I think of Canada thistle in the pasture. If they don't know what this weed or this plant is, give me some background, what it looks like,
yeah.
why it's a problem, those kinds of things.
Yeah, it's pervasive weed. It's a noxious weed here in Illinois. It's a perennial, very spiny, very thorny, has a beautiful purple flower on the top, grows in patches, and that's how you tell the Canada thistle, because it grows in patches. It can spread by seed, but it primarily spreads through the roots that creep out and send up shoots, and that's why you see it growing. You'll never see one alone. If you see one alone, that's probably the bull thistle, but the Canada thistle, you always see it in patches, and those patches will spread forever. And the method that they developed, if I can talk about that for a minute, is really using the life cycle of the plant against itself. It's really interesting. The life cycle of the Canada thistle is that it survives in the ground in the form of roots during the winter. In the spring, it will send up shoots from those apical buds in the roots. And during the initial part of the growth stage in the spring and early summer, it is living off the energy that it stored in the roots the year before, okay, until it flowers. Once it flowers, then it kind of throws a switch and it starts pumping energy back down into the roots. So early on, it's depleting the roots. After it flowers, it's rejuvenating the roots so that it can survive the winter and do it all over again in the spring. And so if you let that thing flower, it's going to keep going and keep spreading. And what we've done is, and most people know this, that if you keep it mowed, keep it from flowering in the spring, what you're doing is you're forcing it to deplete the roots more and more. And so if you take that one step further and till it, let it grow, till it, let it grow, or mow it and let it grow and mow it, keep doing that. And then in June, first 2 weeks in June, till it up good, and then plant a sorghum Sudan grass cover crop, real thick, 50 to 60 pound seed per acre rate. That Sudan grass then grows up and smothers out the rest of the roots, and we've gotten 90%+ of the patches doing that. Now that means you have to kind of, you don't use that land for production, and because it grows in patches, that's really what we're trying to see, is can farmers make this work without taking a whole field out of production? Can they control their thistle this way and still get a crop on the rest of the field?
Yeah, so you're interrupting the life cycle, mm-hmm. the plant, and in a couple of different ways, and then controlling it that way. And because it grows in patches, you're saying, well, if I control just this patch in the field, I'll go out and till it 3-4 times, put the Sudan grass in, or that mix in, and then I can control it. Kind of an interesting sort of thing. It works pretty well then?
It works really well when it's done right and when conditions are right. Had a farmer already this year call me and say that she got flooded out, so the Sudan grass didn't take. And so, you know, things happen like that. But even if you don't want to use a Sudan grass, I've heard of farmers in pastures who have kept the patches mowed, who have mapped out those patches year by year, and just the mowing and keeping it from flowering year after year, you'll see thistle shrink down. And I think most farmers realize that. But in cropping areas, that's not possible.
So. You know, you mentioned one word, and maybe we'll take a moment, a learning moment at this point. You said this is a noxious weed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Definition?
Noxious weed, I would say.
I know the definition. Oh. you know, of course, we learn this as farm boys coming up. Mm-hmm. We learn this in FFA and 4-H. But noxious weeds are those things that when farmers take the grain or oil seeds to the elevator, they get docked for, or they get a discount on the price because that particular weed seed, mm-hmm. Usually it's the weed seed, is noxious or something that they definitely do not want in with the grain because it will make the animal sick generally. Yeah, and I don't know why Canada thistle is a noxious weed, but there's only a small list of these noxious weeds. If I remember 7 or 9 or something along those lines.
So yeah, that's
it's kind of just a little learning moment. Huh? Yeah, all right.
That's good.
But So the anything else about your research on Canada thistle?
We're in the last year of that, and we'll be kind of publishing results here pretty soon on that. So thank you to all the farmers who participated in Illinois and Iowa and Wisconsin in that project. So
how many producers did you have participating? That it's a wide range, but geographically anyway.
See. Total over the 3 years, it was nearly 50 farmers that participated. So,
and did you get generally good comments from them about the way you were researching and the research results? I mean, did they like being able to do this and they thought it was all right? They could manage it.
Yeah, the overall impression was that this definitely works. Seems to work. What we're looking at now, what I'll be looking at this year, is how quickly does it come back? I mean, it's not killing it 100%. And so how many years before it becomes a problem again? And is this a tool that they can use then every few years when it becomes a problem? Or if they do it 2 years in a row, will it really knock it out? You know, things like that. So that's the story.
We're talking with Dan Anderson this afternoon. He's a sustainable ag researcher here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. This is The Farming World. More in a moment.
Support comes from Taylor & Martin Auctions, which is holding an auction of over 100 pieces of large late model ag equipment from John Deere, Case, and Cat on Tuesday, August 10th at 10 a.m. at Progress City in Decatur, Illinois. Online bidding is available at tmilive.com.
It's National Rice Pudding Day. While rice puddings are found in nearly every area of the world, rice was first cultivated in Asia. On this day in agricultural history in 1842, the U.S.-Canada border was defined by the Webster-Ashburton Treaty. The treaty also had clauses for extradition as well as prevention of African slave trade. In 1910, Alva Fisher of Chicago, Illinois, patented the electric washing machine. U.S. electric washing machine sales reached 913,000 units in 1928. By the way, the first laundromat in the U.S. was in Fort Worth, Texas, in 1934. Previous to the electric washing machine, washing machines were cranked by hand, or the wash was scrubbed on a washboard. The scrub board was invented in 1797. In 1911, John Gates died. Gates was an inventor, promoter, and barbed wire manufacturer. He discovered a market for wire fencing on the Western Plains, and he helped convince ranchers to adopt barbed wire. Ultimately, he organized the American Steel and Wire Company. Incidentally, one of the first patents in the U.S. for barbed wire went to Joseph Glidden of DeKalb, Illinois. He made modifications to earlier versions. Glidden's wire, named the Winner, was produced by the Barb Fence Company in DeKalb. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're talking with Dan Anderson today. He's a sustainable ag researcher here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I, the land grant in Illinois. Mr. Anderson, you do some teaching here on campus, like almost everybody as well.
Yeah.
And work with some students. You have some interesting things. Oftentimes that you do with students, I should say. Oftentimes college students and those who are working with them say one of the best things that they can do is to study abroad at some point.
Yeah.
And you, in your sustainable ag research and teaching, take students a couple of different places outside of the country.
Yeah, we're lucky here. The College of Aces really supports the study abroad program. There are lots of opportunities for students to go for whole years, semesters, or for short term. And what I've done, the last two spring breaks, I've taken a group of students to an organic coffee farm down in Brazil, and it has been a fantastic experience for those students and for myself. So this is the farm is actually owned by Brazilian people who live here in Chicago, and I met them up in Chicago at an event, and they were in the process then of converting the farm to organic. The wife, Sylvia Barreto, had just inherited the farm from her father, who had recently passed away. She had a strong interest in organic food and the environment, and said, I will take this farm under one condition: if I can convert it to organic. They talked about it, and they decided together, her and her husband, to do it, to go for it. And so they are 6 or 7 years into that process, and it is a beautiful place, and the students learn a lot about not just coffee, but about this whole concept of sustainability and how it applies to agriculture and to the surrounding communities.
It should be interesting. How many times have you been?
I've been 2 times, and the plan is to make it an annual trip. 9 students each time, mostly women each time, which has been interesting. We've done a lot of different things, and toured neighboring farms as well, and gone whitewater rafting. It's about a 10-day. It's about 1 week. Turns out to be about 8 or 9 days trip.
Why mostly females? Do you have mostly females in the sustainable ag program?
No, that's interesting. I wondered the same thing.
Or are the guys just interested in going to the beaches as opposed to?
I guess study abroad. This is pretty normal that it's the majority of students that go on study abroad trips are females. So the first year I had one male student, and last year I had 9 female students and no male students. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
I'll have to,
I don't know if it's
ask some questions and find out why most of the students that study abroad here on campus are female.
Yeah.
You tell me that's the case, so we'll follow up and see what we can find. So you're on the coffee, on this organic coffee farm production. What do they learn?
They learn how Shade Grown Coffee works, and there's also neighboring farmers that we tour where they grow coffee conventionally, so they see the contrast between the two systems. The whole farm is very unique. They raise all their own food. They have maybe a dozen employees on the farm. They make their own cheese. They milk their own cows. They grow their own vegetables. They grow a variety. They're in the process of expanding and diversifying. They're growing bananas. They're growing lots of other tropical fruits. Coffee is just one crop, which is totally different from the way they grow coffee normally in Brazil. It's a monoculture, just like corn and beans here. And what's interesting is when you talk to those farmers, you hear the same exact things that you hear commodity farmers say here. Prices are too low, costs keep going up, can't keep up, and it's really fascinating, but it's coffee instead of corn and beans.
And when they change, so I'm assuming you're talking about traditionally coffee, but when you go to the organic route, mm-hmm. what do you, generally you bring a premium
yes.
to the price of the coffee, or have they been able to find niche markets for their coffee then?
Yeah, that's where the husband, Marcos, has been really a key player in this. He doesn't know much about production. They have the workers that are doing the production, learning the production and whatnot, but he is the marketer, and that's kind of been his background anyway. He's an importer-exporter kind of guy and a real salesman, and so he has brought buyers from all over the world to the farm to look at the farm, to have cuppings at the farm, and their coffee, the quality of their coffee is really, exceptional for Brazil, for that area of Brazil. I guess Brazil is not known for extraordinarily high quality coffee, but they have been told that their coffee is some of the best in Brazil. And what they do is they really pay attention to detail. I really pay attention to quality. Only pick the ripest beans. They really spend a lot of time separating out the highest quality coffee and marketing it separately from as a brand. They don't sell their coffee into the open market.
No. So the students learn about both sides of production and marketing then mm-hmm. when they go. So they kind of get the whole gamut of what a sustainable ag
yep.
Production facility might be like, because you really it's as much about marketing and finding the niche as it is about production, because if you don't find the niche, there's no use doing the production.
Right. Exactly right. It's no use growing coffee organically or any commodity organically and then dumping it into the open market. It's just, there's no point to that. Even, I don't think they would do as well even if they just took a organic premium. He is really marketing it as a labeled product from their farm, FAF, Fazenda Abiento Fortaleza.
Dan, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Todd.
Dan Anderson is a sustainable ag researcher here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason. You've been listening to The Farming World.